Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host, and I am pleased as punch to be escorting you about a bit of what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world, especially in the company of one of my most admired comrades and colleagues, Fred Grandy, former member of Congress, former talk radio show host, among many other dazzling performances he's turned in on stage and screen. He is now our executive vice president of the Center for Security Policy, and we wrap up the week with him each week. And Fred, a lot has been happening in the past week, and I'd like to visit with you about particularly some of the developments with respect to sort of the rising tide of Islamism as it relates not just to the Middle East, where, of course, we've been seeing it flame on since particularly the anniversary of 9/11, but also in places like France. What's going on there, and what are the implications for places like us far beyond?
Well, as I'm sure you know, this controversial, satirical, and normally left-wing magazine called Charlie Hebdo has just published a series of pretty provocative and insulting cartoons to the religion of Islam and specifically to Muhammad, and of course are being taken to task around the world, but even by no less a person than Jay Carney, the presidential press secretary, who is out bewailing the fact that they're inciting more violence. Interestingly enough, the guy who is the editor of Charlie Hebdo essentially has said in defense, he said, look, I realize this is insulting to Muslims, but I live under French law, not Quranic law. Now, if that works there, you know what bothers me about this, Frank, is France does not have a First Amendment provision as anywhere near as strong as our First Amendment on freedom of speech. And yet they seem to be giving us a lesson in what really is blasphemy versus incitement.
Well, I hope they will, Fred Grandy. I'm a little concerned that we haven't seen the full force of French defense of its law taking place. They're responding somewhat preemptively, I guess, to the fear that some of their embassies might be attacked and maybe some of their schools by closing 20 of their missions around the Middle East, I'm told, and some of their schools, I think, in Africa. Does it seem to you that hats off to this Charlie Hebdo outfit. They had their offices firebombed, as I recall, over a previous episode of this,
and they've
come back for more because they're standing up for freedom of expression. And God love them for saying that they have the right to express it under French law. We're hearing, of course, at the moment. You mentioned Carney at the White House. We're hearing from American officials with respect to this this film, particularly, that has been seized upon as the pretext for violence against U.S. personnel and missions. We gotta really be avoiding this kind of disgusting and reprehensible behavior. How do you see, Fred Grandy, the future of freedom of expression in the West in the face of these Islamist demands that we stop saying things they find offensive?
I think the slow onslaught against free speech that has, I think, now successfully, Charlie Hebdo notwithstanding, swarmed across Europe and incriminated people like Geert Wilders and the Danish journalist Lars Hedegaard and Elisabeth Sabadich Wolf, the Austrian journalist and activist who had the temerity to suggest that when Mohammed married a six-year-old, that was tantamount to child molestation. Of course, that was true, but that cost her a heavy fine and a possible jail sentence. Unfortunately, I think that is now beginning to cross the Atlantic in wafts and in waves. And the more that our State Department accommodates things like Resolution 1618, the OIC resolution trying to make blasphemy a crime, the more we set up the pretext for making insult an injury, but clearly allowing Muslims to be the total and final arbiters of all of these claims.
Yes. It's a stunning thing, and you yourself have had a bit of a taste of this from your previous experience in being censored by people who don't want to give offense to Muslims because of your clarity on precisely these messages. It's one of the things that we value so much about our collaboration with you, Fred Grandy. Speak to me about this this imam in New Jersey, speaking of all of this, by the name of Katani. What is his deal, and how does that bear on what you've just described as a rising threat here?
Well, not surprising. Major and prominent clerics who preside over mosques in the Muslim world are obviously aiding and abetting this whole attempt to move blasphemy laws into the public discourse and prevent any criticism of Islam. But I was not aware until I saw this story this morning that this had now crossed over to, I believe, Passaic, New Jersey. Either way, and I think this guy's first name is Muhammad, which is a pretty good guess. Muhammad Katani presides over one of the largest mosques in New Jersey. As he watches these events unfold across the world, he is essentially warning Americans that we should be very mindful that criticizing Islam in any way can produce a threat to our national security. His word, not mine. Now here's what's even more troubling about this, Frank. Muhammad Katani, in his time as a religious cleric, has had to fight back deportation attempts by the Department of Homeland Security for things that he has said and done. And, of course, he's very critical of things like the Holy Land Foundation trial and has been very outspoken about the spread of Islam and the criticism of Islam. But one of his foremost defenders, and I assume this is true even now, is the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who has no problem with whatever this guy says, and will defend his right to say it. Now, again, that's freedom of speech, of course. But if it works to defend him, it certainly should work to defend Charlie Hebdo or innocence of Muslims or any of the people in this country, whether it's you or me or anybody that we know, has presumed to say about Islam.
Yeah, and most especially if folks like, and I believe it's actually Muhammad Katanani, is actually engaged in this at least oblique threat of violence if we don't conform. That really, two things. One, it is a reminder of what we're up against. And two, it says how outrageous is this alliance between Governor Chris Christie, who entertained him and actually sang his praises at an iftar dinner held in the governor's mansion recently. You know, this is not the kind of guy you want to be promoting, let alone aiding and abetting, as Chris Christie has done. We're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk about, Fred Grandy, as we usually do. Let me quickly turn to Afghanistan, where we are witnessing the now, I guess, separation of our military personnel from those that they have, until very recently, been commanded to spend a lot of time with, training and otherwise preparing to accept our handoff. Quickly, Fred, what is happening there and what are the implications of it for, you know, a good outcome in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think there are any implications for a good outcome. The only thing that at least gives me some relief about now separating NATO, Western, and, of course, American troops from Afghani troops is hopefully that will stem the tide of green-on-blue violence, which we've been reporting on and talking about, even though we've yet to have a military leader or anybody from the State Department say this has anything to do with ideology. I mean, I think we talked before about how military leaders were speculating this had to do with being hungry at the end of Ramadan and hot weather and just things that are totally ridiculous. But I think this is a decision that's long overdue. And as far as I'm concerned, I just wonder what our mission could possibly be now, other than to turn tail and get out of there.
Yeah, well, that is my guess exactly what President Obama has in mind once the election is behind him and he doesn't have to assume responsibility for the defeat that this is really translating into, sadly. Fred Grandy, as always, it is wonderful to have a chance to visit with you. The news is not good, but it is always good to be able to review it with you. And I hope we'll have a chance to do so early and often next week. In the meantime, stay very well, and thank you for the great work you're doing at the Center for Security Policy. And in other talk radio show capacities, I know you've been guest hosting for Andy Parks in the Washington market here, and congratulations on that. We'll talk again next
Doubling
week.
Our voice.
There you go. In the meantime, stay very well.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express travel service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by a man I hold in the highest of esteem, both by virtue of his service to our country in uniform and as a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, as a commentator on the national security and foreign policy issues of our day, notably with Fox News, and as an author of absolutely extraordinary accomplishment, including most recently a book entitled Kane at Gettysburg. He is, of course, Ralph Peters, and it is a great pleasure to have you back with us, Ralph, especially at a moment when there is so much afoot. Let me ask you this. We have, as I was just discussing with Fred Grandy in the previous segment, a drama unfolding in Afghanistan, whereby the whole policy that we have been pursuing for some time as the stated approach to extricating us from that country with honor, namely handing off to Afghans we're training, is now obviously knocked into a cocked hat as attacks by the Afghan folks we're training have now resulted in the loss of a great number of American lives, of course, but now in a policy that says, wait a minute, we're going to separate you guys. What is going on and where do we go from here in your estimation?
Well, we have to look back to how it started. The choices in Afghanistan were between a sensible, minimalist approach. What we did initially, go to Afghanistan, smash Al-Qaeda, punish the Taliban for hosting them, and then we should have left, and leaving a residual presence of special operators to keep killing terrorists. Instead, the Bush administration went for a maximalist, turn Afghanistan into Wisconsin, impossible mission, and the Obama administration, because he needed to appear strong on some security issue, went to Afghanistan by default and wildly compounded the Bush administration's mistake. And so at present, we're stuck in a tragic farce in which no matter how much money we spend, no matter how many lives we sacrifice, we can't make Afghans stop being Afghans. And that's essentially what we've been trying to do. We stepped into the middle of a civil war, pretended there was no civil war, pretended everybody work together like the ethnic groups in an American squad in a John Ford movie from World War II. It just doesn't work. We stepped into a traditional culture that values its tradition, however incomprehensible that may be to us, and they really don't want to be third-rate Americans. So now we're at a situation where the president, President Obama, who dramatically worsened the situation with his troop increases, his surge, is now congratulating himself because he's calling off the surge and bringing back the troops. The situation's an absolute mess. And in Washington, huge egos, civilian and military, are wrapped up in this. So it reminds me of one of the climactic scenes in that brilliant American philosophical film, Animal House, where you have the parade and everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and there's an ROTC cadet out there waving his arms saying, all will be well, all will be well. And I hear our generals saying, all will be well, and they're in their air-conditioned headquarters surrounded by layers of security. And whenever I talk with any troops, special operators, line doggies, who are actually out in the front lines or recently have been, they are unanimous that this is a deadly joke, a farce. And there's really a problem here of egos. We can't admit we made a mistake on this one. And, you know, the way you present it, I'm tired of people saying, oh, but it'll be a disaster for America's image. Well, check out our image in the Muslim world this week.
Wanted to go with you next, Ralph Peters, is let's talk a little bit about what's happening in this broader arena of our relations with these, I think of them as Sharia-adherent Islamists who seem to be now increasingly taking away, not only from perhaps the experience you've just described in Afghanistan, but more generally our approach to them, that this is the moment to game on vis-a-vis jihad.
Yeah, I mean, in Afghanistan, it's such a shy sideshow. It really doesn't matter to us. It mattered to the Brits in the 19th century as a buffer against Imperial Russia. But where we're seeing the wild riots now are the oil countries, the strategically positioned countries, the ones that really matter. And, you know, certainly there is a struggle for the soul of every one of the world's great religions right now. In Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it's carried out in a relatively civilized manner. It's primarily about debate. Hinduism, you get in some violence. But when you get to the Muslim world, the religion that developmentally is lagging much farther behind all the others, it's turned bloody. And so on one level, we're seeing a multi-sided civil war among Muslims for the future of Islam, if it has a future, and not just a past. We're also seeing, and the establishment media just ignore this entirely, a remarkable parallel between President Obama's blaming all of America's ills on America's rich and the Muslims of the Middle East blaming all of their ills on rich America. We're all, beyond the religious civil war, we're seeing global class warfare. And in Washington, as you know, Frank, you're a Washington hand, nobody ever talks about jealousy as a strategic factor. That's not a part of the theories in Princeton and Yale and Harvard. But in fact, jealousy is just as profound an influence on the fates of peoples and nations as it is on individual lives. And essentially, we're facing people who are religious maniacs who are jealous of America's success.
Yeah, and who have, I would argue, Ralph Peters, and you've written extensively on these subjects, so I know I'm speaking to an authority, but I would argue that underneath that religious patina is very much a political agenda. And again, they call it Sharia, whatever we decide to call it. It's something they're moving forward with. We're again speaking with Ralph Peters. You see him frequently at Fox News. He is the author, among many other books, of the very germane one entitled Endless War, Middle Eastern Islam versus Western Civilization. Ralph, in the remaining time with you, I'd like to back the lens still further up, if we can, and ask you to address why is it that with these extraordinary things happening around the world with such palpable implications for our interests, and indeed, I would argue, for our security, these subjects are scarcely being addressed in this campaign for the presidency underway now, reaching its denouement. And actually, to the extent they're addressed at all, it's addressed mostly in the context of what a splendid job President Obama is doing with respect to all of this.
Yeah, well, I think there should be no question in anybody's mind that the establishment media desperately wants to reelect President Obama. He's their guy. And they're not going to cover anything in a negative that puts him in a negative light. I was stunned when the media covered Romney's criticism of the administration's actions in Libya and treated it as though he shot from the hip, when in fact we saw it was the White House that shot from the hip before the facts were in, told outright lies. It was all about the movie. It wasn't planned. There was plenty of security. And they're still lying now, although they're passing it off to the FBI because that gives them cover. They say, well, we can't talk about it. I mean, if the Bush administration had let down its guard on one of the anniversaries of September 11th, the way the Obama administration did, imagine the scandal that would have been. I mean, Obama is perceived by not just the radical Islamists, but by the Chinese, by the Russians, by Hugo Chavez as a very, very weak man. He's a president who makes Jimmy Carter look like the Incredible Hulk. And his Russia policy has failed. His Iran policy has failed. He's never had a China policy until now. He's suddenly discovering that American workers are out of jobs because of China. His reset with the Middle East, where he's going to apologize his way to peace, love, and understanding. Well, you see the results of that in the streets, because in the Middle East, men don't apologize. I mean, he didn't do his homework. In the Middle East, men don't apologize unless their status is so low and so weak that they have to apologize to survive, and then they're regarded as womanly. So he never cared about foreign policy. He thought his charm would win over Putin, Mullah Omar, and everybody else in sight, and he has failed utterly comprehensively. Even the drone campaign, for which I give him credit for conducting it, carrying it on, but you know, the only reason the Bush administration didn't do as much as Obama did was because we didn't have as many drones. But the orders for the drones were in place under the Bush administration, and Obama benefited from the fact that they became available. They were finally built. Killing Osama bin Laden, any president would have. And by the way, you know, Obama didn't do that with his bare hands. It was the Navy SEALs.
No kidding. And there's evidence that he declined to do it on a couple of occasions before getting around to it.
They had to twist his arm and threaten him to get him to do it.
Ralph, I'm so sorry. This is such a superb critique and analysis of what we're up against, and your voice is so important at this particular moment in time, because if we don't get this right, folks, you can bet that what is coming next is not just more of the same, but much worse. Both in terms of American policy, I suspect, and certainly in terms of the reaction to it. Ralph Peters, thank you so much for joining us and for your insights. I hope you'll be back much, much sooner in the future than we've had you back in the past, and I look forward to it with great expectation.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope and life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Neil Monroe. He is the White House correspondent for the Daily Caller, having had, to this point, a very distinguished career in journalism, covering many of the most important beats of our time. He is also the author of The Quick and the Dead, Electronic Combat and Modern Warfare. Important books all. It's great to have you with us, Neil Monroe. I'm very anxious, particularly, to get your reading on some of the things that have been going on as you see them from the perspective of the White House. So welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, thanks very much. It's always fun to be in a show with Americans.
Well, good. Listen, we have a situation here, as they say. We are being told, as you know, that some video out in California that, as best I can tell, nobody has seen, has precipitated this wild upsurge of, in many cases, violent jihadist activity against us, and that none of it was premeditated. All of it is spontaneous and simply a response to this action, and not in any way, shape, or form related to America policy as pursued by the Obama administration. I know you've been hearing that from Jay Carney and others at the White House. What do you make of that line?
Yeah, right from the beginning, the administration has pushed this line. Somehow the video was responsible for the upsurge of protests and the lethal attack on the Benghazi consulate that took place on September 11th. It's an implausible claim, and even the establishment reporters who go to the White House briefings are becoming more skeptical about it. It's implausible because we can see the video of supposed protesters carrying anti-tank rockets at the Benghazi embassy. It's preposterous because we know that the raid, the protest and semi-occupation of the Cairo embassy was organized by a jihadi Islamist group that is seeking to maximize its political power in Egypt by calling for an amnesty for the blind sheikh who was jailed in 95 for trying to blow up the Twin Towers. That same group which organized the September 11th protest outside and then inside the embassy boosted its numbers by having an Egyptian fundamentalist Islamic group broadcast slices of this little-known satirical video to an Egyptian audience, and that spurred the protest turnout on September 11th. But really, the administration's claim doesn't hold water because it seems to portray Egyptians as sort of robots who respond automatically to some California YouTube upload.
Yeah. Neil, let me just ask you. You, of course, witness close at hand, day in and day out, the policymakers and the fruits of their efforts at the Obama White House. To what extent have, in what you've seen so far, they conveyed, in distinction to this claim that there is really nothing to do with their policies, an approach to this region, to more to the point, Sharia or Islam, if you will, but specifically towards Sharia, that is accommodating of it, and that in fact might have a lot more to do with what we're seeing at the moment than this purported pretext.
Yeah, but I would argue that the administration's policy is a semi-organized shambles, not a coherent, organized philosophy. The president wanted to distinguish himself from President Bush, who used force to knock over this sort of Arab socialist Ba'athist dictator in Iraq. And in contrast to the Republicans' use of force, Democrats said, well, we can talk our way to better relations with the Arab world. And so they consciously ingratiated themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood, believing they could persuade them to be friendly and modern. I know that's why Obama went to Cairo in 2009 and launched his New Beginning speech. It was pitched as a diplomatic outreach to the Brotherhood Islamists. Well, in the years since, Obama helped the Brotherhood gain power in Egypt and some other countries, especially in Libya, where he used the Air Force to knock out Gaddafi, allowing Islamists, but not quite necessarily Brotherhood guys, to take over. So the president has, in effect, also in Turkey, in effect aided the Brotherhood governments, and now he discovers to his surprise that the Islamists are not friends of the United States. And so he's trying to say that the conflict caused by Islamists pushing and criticizing the U.S. is actually caused by the video. In far more likelihood, it's caused by, if you like, the spread of populist democracy in these countries, where now we have many Egyptian parties, Libyan parties, Turkish parties, for that matter, arguing and seeking popularity by blaming the United States and non-Muslims for the failures of their own societies to modernize, the failure of education, failure of productivity, failure of agricultural production. So we're the scapegoat of Arab populist politics. But those are populist politics the president helped create.
Right. Our guest is Neil Monroe. He is the White House correspondent for a splendid internet-based publication known as The Daily Caller. And, Neil, let me just drill down on that for a moment, because you've said something that I find a little bit surprising, I must say, namely that President Obama was kind of naively hoping that he could sweet-talk the Muslim Brotherhood into behaving better, as opposed to actually having considerable sympathy for the purposes of the Muslim Brotherhood and having this work out, if not in all of its particulars, but rather more along the lines that that he prefers. I say this in connection with sort of the thesis that Obama has a sympathy for the downtrodden and particularly the Muslim downtrodden that has been much in evidence throughout his administration. Is that not possible?
Yeah, but this is a gauzy, ignorant kind of sympathy. Like, so the poor, benighted Arabs who've been so done wrong by the West. And he just doesn't seem to understand that Arabs are proud and they have their own view of the world and they're going to fight for it. And so he seems to have grossly underestimated the diversity, forgive the phrase, of Arab politics. He thought he could sweet talk these Islamists into, you know, being nice and respectful and promoting peace. But, I mean, you can argue that he's been indulgent of the Islamists, and that seems fair. But it's a long stretch to argue that he knew how nasty and self-aggrandizing and supremacist the Brotherhood is. We don't see the evidence that the president really understands Islam or the Arabs. And so in that sense, you can't say he understood what he has helped to create. It's perfectly plausible that some of his deputies are one way or the other. Some of them are simply more connected to the Brotherhood than he. But even then, it's not at all clear. The Brotherhood and the Islamist guys, they're not unified. They sort of share a common book, the Quran, but they're sort of upper class. There's sort of middle class guys. There's Western trained guys. There's sort of untrained people. There's Egyptians. There's Tunisians.
But Neil, we're going to run out of time, and I just want to make we'll get to one last point. I hope you're right. I fear you're wrong about that. But there certainly is, in addition to the book, they have this Sharia code that they share and are seeking to impose. But just very quickly, one of the people who the president will be hanging with this week, this coming week, is Mohamed Morsi, as you know, the president of Egypt. Doesn't seem to have time for Prime Minister Netanyahu, but does have time for Mohamed Morsi. One of the agenda items appears to be acting on this, if not before the election, after this demand of Morsi that we release the blind sheikh. What are you hearing about that?
So the administration sort of backing away from their planned meeting with Morsi, and it's hard to believe they'll ever release the sheikh who tried to knock down the Twin Towers in 95. But Morsi, the Egyptian president, called in public and made it part of his election platform. This is the kind of politics that Obama has released, opened up, and helped create via his new beginning, and it is highly implausible the president wants to release this thug from jail. Yet he's created the politics now where Morsi and his supposed partners in Egypt are calling for this. There's lots of other areas where the president finds himself caught between a rock and a hard place. So these Islamist parties are now calling for restrictions on free speech, and the president isn't denouncing them. Well, partly because maybe those Egyptian Islamists are threatening him back. One of them said the other day, the prime minister of Egypt said, you know, you should really help us out on this whole don't insult the prophet thing, or else there might be more protests.
There might be more protests. There might be more violence, indeed. Neil, we have to leave it at that. I have so much more I'd love to talk with you about, and we look forward to doing so at an early opportunity. But thank you for visiting with us a little bit and bringing the White House perspective as you see it day in and day out as the reporter there for the Daily Caller. Keep up the great work and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we have Bill Gertz joining us.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, as we have the privilege of being each week, for a tour of what we think of as Inside the Ring. His column of that name, of course, is a required reading item in Washington and elsewhere. It is featured at the Washington Times. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, where he does extraordinary reporting on national security matters. Bill is also the author of myriad best-selling books, including The Failure Factory. And Bill, you have been covering intensively of late several different aspects of the China story. I'm not quite sure where to begin, but maybe with the current rising tensions between China and Japan over the so-called Senkaku Islands. This seems to me to be a case of what the totalitarians have called social engineering, vectoring people at a foreign enemy to justify internal repression in a time of, you know, dislocation, economic and political. How do you see it?
Pretty much that way. This is a very tense situation between China and Japan over the Senkakus, but there are also disputes in the South China Sea as well. China is stepping up its kind of xenophobic approach, and what set off the current crisis was the Japanese government's purchase of two privately held islands in the Senkaku chains, which has been Japan's for years, and all of a sudden the Chinese are trying to get these fishing grounds that also have resources. And we've seen riots, government-produced riots throughout China, and blustering by one of the top generals who met just recently with Leon Panetta. And this general said that told the PLA troops that they should prepare for combat. And U.S. officials say this is very unusual for this vice chairman of the Central Military Commission, the real ultimate military authority in China, to make such a statement.
Hmm. And you said something that I just want to key off of here, Bill. There have been lots of protests and demonstrations in recent years, as you know, in China. Almost all of them against the government, against, you know, the local party officials on grounds of corruption or in environmental predation or other types of political or economic issues. This seems to be of a very different kind, doesn't it? That these are, in fact, not only sanctioned by the government, but in some ways facilitated by them. And it raises the question, Bill Gertz, do you think that the Chinese Communist Party maybe unleashing, you know, sentiments, war fever, if you will, against Japan that will not be controllable?
That's definitely a real danger. And it seems as though the government is trying to scale back some of these protests, which involved burning Japanese businesses, overturning cars, really over-the-top kind of protests, like signs that read, "Kill all the Japanese," and "We will die to take over the islands that they claim." And the government seems to be dialing back a little bit of this. The context of this is also that we have a growing problem of protests throughout the Middle East, which is a distraction for the U.S. And also we have a big leadership change coming up within the next several weeks in China. I mean, they're going to change the top leader. And it's clear from the recent trial related to the Boshi Lai affair that there are probably some divisions within the Chinese leadership. So that may, in fact, be why they are pressing these xenophobic claims over these islands, which are located south of Okinawa and north of Taiwan.
Yeah, interesting. Bill, you've mentioned Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, was in China this week. Meeting with senior officials, he was taken, I guess, pretty much solo into a heretofore off-limits naval facility, I believe it was. You've reported that we've been treated to yet another military program about which we either knew very little or were surprised to discover that it was as far along as it is. Tell us about that specific instance, and more generally, are we really chasing the will of the wisp as the U.S. Secretary of Defense seeks better military contacts and transparency?
Yeah, this Leon Panetta has been traveling in China for the last several days, and the purpose of his trip was to try to convince the Chinese that the pivot to Asia by the U.S., which is a major effort to counter China's anti-access and area denial weapons, things like anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-satellite weapons, and cyber capabilities. And he has not convinced the Chinese at all. In fact, the day before he arrived,
convinced them pointedly that this isn't a threat to China.
Yeah, well, he came out and said that the Chinese don't believe it. They say that the U.S. is out to try to contain China and that he's trying to pretend that it's not directed at China when in fact it is. So he's sending a mixed message, and the message is being misread by Beijing.
But Bill Gertz, let me ask you this, and I do want to come back to this question of, you know, transparency and all that. To the extent that the Chinese are seeing this as a threat, and perhaps ramping up their pressure on the Japanese at the moment in the belief that it hasn't yet materialized, that threat, and may never, frankly. I must say I'm a bit unpersuaded that this is a real capability that he's bringing to bear simply because of the budget cuts. Could we find ourselves with a conflict happening there at the same time that things seem to be going from bad to worse in the Middle East?
Absolutely. I'm very, very concerned about it because the U.S. is sending a mixed message. On the one hand, Panetta came out and said that we're not involved in the territorial dispute. But on the other hand, when he was in Tokyo before he reached China, he said the U.S. will abide by its U.S.-Japan defense treaty. In other words, if the Chinese miscalculate and try to take some military step to against some Japanese coastal patrol boat, the U.S. has said that we're committed under this defense treaty to defend Japan. So that's why I say things are very tense. You have the Chinese really over the top with their rhetoric and moving warships to the area.
Yeah, and so let's go back to this buildup as well. That unlike ours, I think in the pivot, theirs is very real. There's a new stealth fighter that was rolled out
this
week.
They released photos of a second stealth jet that's under development. It's been variously dubbed the J-21 or the J-31. The first photos of it were made public on the internet the day before Panetta arrived, and it's clear that this happened the last time when Defense Secretary Gates visited China. They actually flight tested the J-20, which is their first stealth fighter. So clearly there's saber rattling and chest thumping on the part of the Chinese military.
And Bill, does it look to you as though, take for example this visit to the naval facility by the Secretary of Defense, we're actually likely to see any of this made less threatening by improved military to military contacts, if even the Chinese will go along with those?
No, this is just a totally naive approach by the Obama administration, that if they think that they can, quote, build trust with the Chinese. The Chinese view the United States as their main enemy. They have no interest in being a stakeholder with the U.S. in the U.S. system. They want to dominate the region, and they want to drive the United States out of Asia. And clearly that message has not been understood by the Defense Secretary as he goes there. He actually talked about recently about doing cooperation in cybersecurity, which, of course, is one of the key niche weapon systems that the Chinese are developing and using.
Yeah, cooperating there is unlikely to actually improve our security, may improve the threat against us. Very quickly, we've got a minute, Bill, and I mean it. Be very brief, if you would. A military report out of a military intelligence report says the Iranians are also engaged in cyber attacks on our institutions. What's going on?
Yes, the Pentagon's joint staff in an internal report recently stated that Iran conducted an attempted cyber attack on a major U.S. financial institute, and that this type of aggressive cyber attacks combined with Iran's support for terrorism are a clear sign that Tehran is engaged in a covert war against the West. Well, that's not new. The fact that it's reported certainly contradicts the more conciliatory policies of the Obama administration.
It certainly does. Bill Gertz, more on that to come. Thank you so much for joining us this week, for the superb work you do at the Washington Free Beacon and, of course, with your Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times. We appreciate very much the chance to visit with you each week and look forward to our conversation next week. We look forward to talking with the rest of you next week as well. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.